I'll start with a brief introduction about the subject. I'll be talking about super conformal field theories in six dimensions. There are several reasons that one might be interested in these. And for string theorists, perhaps one of the most known reasons is that there is a super conformal field theory that is believed to be describing the effective Lagrangian on a M5 brain, or perhaps not even effective actually. And that is known to have 2,0 supersymmetry. But in general, we might be interested in the subject just as an interesting question in quantum field theory, about quantum field theories in general. Because you see, for example, if you try to define a gauge theory in a dimension higher than 4, what happens is that the gauge capping explodes in the UV, and it makes the definition of your theory problematic. It's in many ways similar to the problems that we encounter with quantum gravity. So you might even think of this problem as a toy problem, the quantum gravity, something similar but perhaps easier. Something that has happened more recently is that it has become an interesting tool, but it has been revived more recently. It has become an interesting tool to study also four-dimensional or even three-dimensional field theories. But well, in this place, I might be preaching to the Pope, so perhaps I shouldn't stress this point too much. So it would be interesting to have a classification of six-dimensional super conformal field theories. Well, perhaps conformal field theories in general, but as always, a problem becomes more tractable if you also have supersymmetry. But the 2,0 theory is actually unique, but perhaps you can try to study less supersymmetry, 1,0. There is also the possibility of having 1,0 in six dimensions. This is just a way of labeling the amount of supersymmetry in six dimensions. And as we will see, this might actually even be useful as a proxy to study this case. This is more or less similar to what has happened over the last few years for the M2 brain theory, which has an equal state, but by losing some supersymmetry, by giving up some supersymmetry, you might be able to understand a little more about the dynamics of the theory. So it would be good to have a classification of such theories, but today we are going to at least see, classify the possible holographic duals. So this doesn't mean, at least I'm classifying all the 1,0 theories that have a holographic dual, and that should be more or less the theories with a large N expansion, so to speak. So in other words, we are going to classify ADS7 solutions in type 2 theories. Now, you might say, wait a second, I think I know already that there is only basically this one in 11 dimensions that then can be reduced to type 2a. And yeah, in 11 dimensions, that is actually correct. If you impose just by the symmetry of ABS7, if you want to keep it, you find that the only thing you can switch on is G4, the G4 flux of 11 dimensions supergravity along the internal space, M4. That's basically a Freund-Rubin type of solution. And this has been known for a long time. So basically what you end up demanding is that the cone over M4, which is a five-dimensional manifold, should have reduced holonomy. This is just a couple steps. It's very easy. And then you go ask your mathematician friends, and they tell you that actually that's not possible in five dimensions. You can't have reduced holonomy except for a very stupid case, which is R5 mod ZK. So R5 mod ZK is a cone over what? Over S4 mod ZK. So that's all you have. So there's nothing new here. So the talk doesn't stop here, though. You might think that it does stop, because then I'm telling you, oh, 2A, you can obtain it by reducing from 11 dimensional supergravity. And I will tell you that in this talk that in 2B, you also don't have any solutions. Well, it's talking about supersymmetric solutions, of course. However, no, the talk is not over. You have the possibility of massive 2A. This version of the theory does not have a lift to 11 dimensions, and hence the argument I showed you in the previous slide does not completely kill the problem. And indeed, I will show you that there are many new solutions if you do include this mass parameter into a supergravity. Now, what type of solutions will we see? Now, since we are in 10 dimensions, no longer in 11, here we expect to have a three-dimensional manifold. Then what will the manifold be? It will be an S2 vibration of the interval with a topology which is S3. And the reason I'm saying topology is that only topologically there will be S3. Actually, there will be somehow distorted. And the reason this S2, though, in the fibers is not will not be distorted, basically because it has to realize the asymmetry, the SU2 asymmetry, or SP1 asymmetry that appears in a 1,0 supersymmetric theory in six dimensions. And for example, I thought I would whet your appetite with a couple of pictures. By the way, these pictures are after preparing these pictures for some time, I found out that you usually have your group meetings in another room and people give Blackboard talks, but after spending all this time preparing these pictures, I thought I would show them. So, this is one type of solution that we will find with some distortion that ends up in a cusp where the six brains, or many D6 brains are sitting. And another type, which is in a sense more benign, is where you actually have D8, D6 bound states, which are stabilized by flux. So basically, well, maybe I'm anticipating too much here, but basically they are held in place by their mutual electric attraction, whereas the gravitation will want to go off towards the poles here. So as you see this up, I mean, of course these are S2s, not S3s, but you have to imagine one dimension more so that these are the circles here, the meridians are the parallels are the S2s that I'm talking about here. So this is what we will see basically. But I will begin actually by a brief description of what techniques we used to achieve this classification. That might be boring to people who want to see directly what the end result of the classification is, but I thought I would give you an idea of how these things generally work. Then we will start, I will give you a general classification. I will tell you all that we can say in general without, so perhaps I should stress, I haven't made any ansatz in reaching those. So those are, of course, I showed you only two pictures, and we believe that there are solutions in many. I showed you a picture with two D8s, for example, but we believe there should be solutions in many D8s. And at that point, I cannot claim I have a complete classification because there's also a numerical system to study. But up to a certain point, I can give you a complete classification in the sense that there's no answer whatsoever. So we reduce the problem basically to solving an ODE without ever assuming anything. And finally, I'll show you the SPC solutions. I'll tell you something more about the SPC solutions that for which you just saw an artist impression. And the artist would be me, I guess. So let's start with the methods. So this is part of a general approach that I've been following for some time to, I think, post-particle, an approach that post-particle in solving many supergravity problems in several dimensions. And basically, the idea is to work on T plus T star, the tangent plus cotangent. So instead of working with vectors or with one forms, you somehow sum them together. And that, well, there are several virtues of that approach, but without getting too technical, basically, in type 2 theories, you have two supersymmetry parameters. And when you want to study the geometry defined by these supersymmetry parameters, each of them would define what's called the G structure, a certain geometrical structure on the manifold. But well, G is a group, really. But since there are two spinors, when you have two, they define two G structures, and now you have to, if you want to analyze this system that comes on supersymmetry, you will end up having to look at all the possibilities for how these groups defined by epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 intersect with each other. And the math there can become a bit cumbersome. So at some point, an alternative strategy emerged, which is to use the same mathematics of G-structure, but applied on this T plus T star. This it's called sometimes a generalized tangent bundle, and you can think of it. You're basically using the generalized so the generalized Lorentz group. So you're doing differential geometry instead of with the local Lorentz transformations as your guiding light with this generalized local Lorentz, which has matrices that act on twice the dimension. Well, this probably didn't make you understand much, but the bottom line is that you find, in the end, nicer equations, and it's easier to understand whether the system you wrote down is actually equivalent to the original one you started with. And so it's easier to find solutions in the end. So in the end, what you work with is just differential forms, and this is stuff that you can give to a mathematician or give to a computer, and you don't have to do any guesses about what the supersymmetric parameters are. So it's getting slightly more technical only for this one slide. The original example of this strategy was for compactifications to four dimensions, which of course are interesting for a number of reasons. And in that case, the internal space for type 2 theories, of course, is a six-dimensional space. And you have that the G structure that they define on this generalized tangent bundle is a so-called SU3 times SU3 structure. And the differential equations are not showing right now, but they are comparatively nice, and they reveal a number of things about the what M6 should be, such as the statement that M6 should be a generalized complex space as defined by Nigel Hitchin around 2003. Then, well, a number of other cases emerged over the years, and then at some point I basically got fed up and I tried to find the most general result. I mean, the strategy that would work for any 10-dimensional manifold, I mean, for any answers you had in mind, perhaps a black hole in four dimensions or an ADS 7 or ADS 6 or whatever you want. And well, it was a bit of a challenge, so I'll tell you by simplifying things a bit that this is the relevant structure. It has that complicated shape there basically because of the Lorentz signature of the metric on M10. And you get basically this equation. So all the equations that I called nice here descend from this single equation. So basically, there's one master equation that you need to solve. Unfortunately, there are some spoilers, but these extra equations that are not showing here, in most of the situations that you care about are irrelevant. They are void. they don't they are redundant. What are these guys? Well, phi is just a form that disguises mathematically this guy here, this structure. H is just a Neve-Schwarz tree form. This see, I start seeing this fact that you have t plus t star. This is a vector, so it's in t, and this is a one form, so it's in t star. F is the total Ramon-Ramon flux, just the sum of the all the k forms, even forms into A and odd forms into B. And well, this, like I said, implies that case, but then you can also use it directly to get an ADS7 solution. Now, in practice, it was actually easier to go to this case that had actually been already analyzed. And well, then any ADS7 solution can be thought of as a Minkowski 6 solution, where the M4 is some kind of cone over the M3, not really cone, a Wurth cone over M3. But anyway, that's just a technical detail. There are many ways, let's say, that you can get here. So eventually, one gets a system of differential equations on M3. And what is that system? Well, let me show you first. So then, some further details, but I'm almost done. I will soon get to a system where you don't need to know the origin. It's just a system of forms that you need to solve. So basically, now the 10-dimensional spinors, epsilon1 and epsilon2, on M3, they define spinors chi1 and 2 on the tree manifold. And both of them define a field bind, which is, in Mathematica, you can also call it an identity structure. Whatever, this is just a name, but it's part of the reason that I wrote identity times identity in the previous slide. And now, getting slightly more concrete, what do you do? So you build these two spinors, bispinors, sorry. So chi 2 bar is just Majorana conjugate chi 2, and then you take the dagger. These are bispinors. Both of them are bispinors. They have two spinorial indices. But bispinors are basically the same as forms, because you can expand them along anti-symmetrized products of gamma matrices, and then you can apply this map that sometimes is called Clifford map, which is, you actually know already, it's just what you do when you slash anti-symmetric tensor. What you do, you take the x's and you replace them by products of gammas. So using this, we end up with some forms. So basically, both chi1 and chi2 define a field bind, but instead of working with two field bind, which is I find a bit confusing, these two should be two field bind for the same metric, but instead of doing that, it's more practical to use a single field bind and then three angles that somehow parameterize the transformation that would take one field bind to the other. That's more or less the idea. And sorry, I realized at some point that I had, one of the angles is called psi, which has nothing to do with these, which are forms. So this will now create a slightly confusing equation. But this is an example of, at the end of this process, you get forms that look like this, for example. It sounded overly fancy, but you get something like this. Sorry, this is someone. I'm showing a mix, actually. I did a mistake. I meant to write here psi1 plus the even part of the form. And this is certainly an even form. This is a zero form. And this too, sorry, I didn't make any mistake. So this is a two form, so it's also even. And so it's just we now have a set of forms, psi one and psi two, even part and odd part. And you plug them into the system that I promised, which looks like this. So, okay, so this looks long, but it's just a differential system, and you know, these are just form equations that really, literally, you can make them into a computer. So literally, that's what I did. And once you input those expressions for psi 1 plus and psi 2 plus, and minuses as well, which are just actually the star of the pluses, and you get a number of results. Well, first, perhaps I should tell you what these guys are. Let me remind you, F is the total Ramon-Ramon flux. Actually, for us, it's now the internal part. So for our problem, all that we can allow for in order not to break the symmetries of the system is the, well, in the 2A case, F0 and F2 along the internal space, and in 2B, F1 and F3. As for the other guys, well, I used this shortcut. This D minus H wedge appeared already a few slides ago. A is the warping function that multiplies e to the 2A basically multiplies the seven-dimensional the metric of the ADS7, and this double sign here shows you that this, the system is actually the same in 2A and 2B. This is another nice feature of this generalized business of this generalized complex geometry approach to supersymmetric solutions. You work only once. You find a system that is formally the same for both theories, and then you can analyze it separately. I mean, and actually, this is where a fork in the road appears, because I believe I've told you everything I needed to tell you about the system, and now we can analyze it first for 2B and then for 2A. So let's look at the 2B case. These are three of those five equations. Let me take the zero form part. Well, you remember there was a field bind. What was appearing in those size? Field bind and a bunch of angles. Now, the field bind cannot appear, of course, in the zero form part. And you see that here. So, okay, the zero form part only receives actually a contribution from the right hand side, because on the left hand side, you have this D differential that raises the degree by one. So if you start, at best you can get a two form part, but not a zero form part, because to obtain a zero form part, you should act on a minus one form that doesn't exist. So you have a bunch of zeros on the left hand side and a bunch of angles. I guess I repeated equals zero a couple of times for good measure. And so, well, you look at those equations and you see that actually they're telling you that there's no solution. That was me, sorry. I thought it would actually play over the speaker for some reason, but it didn't work. So there's no solution in 2B. That's it. That's the proof that there are no solutions in 2B. So all that work that we did before, now pays off, or doesn't pay, I mean, depending on how you define paying off. So now, how about 2A? Perhaps we'll have more luck this time. So as you can see, the system is the same. It just changed the minuses into pluses and vice versa. That's it as far as changing from 2AB to 2A goes. Now you, these are even for odd form equations, and you cannot take the zero form part again. Good, so I won't die that easily. But something striking happens anyway. So these guys here now begin with the zero form, and so you have D of a bunch of angles. And here, if you go look at what happens, you have field bind, and so you, if you work a bit, you actually get an expression that tells you what the field bind are in terms of these angles that originally we had used as a parameterization. These angles originally were thought, usually you think of them as a bunch of functions that live on your internal manifolds. But now after staring at this, you realize that really this is suggesting to you a local form of the metric, just because those thetas really look like coordinates. And so the system is kind of automatically suggesting to you how you should make sense of the solution globally. But first, well, actually, when you go look at the metric in terms of these original angles, it looks like a mess. Then you work a bit, and you find that there's a change of variables. It's complicated, so I'm not showing it. But with that change of variables, the metric becomes amazingly easy. And that's how it is. So you have dr squared plus some function times the metric of the S2. Now, if this function here, 1 minus x squared, were a cosine, then this would be the metric, the round metric on S3. But, well, it isn't. But what is x of r? This is some function that I will soon tell you something about. But now we just know that it's some kind of sausage-like, perhaps, vibration where you have an S2 evolving with r that parameterizes a certain a line or perhaps an interval. We'll see. And like I said before, this S2 is there. So you shouldn't surprise us that we got, I presented it like as a miracle almost. But actually, it shouldn't be because we expected the S2 to emerge. This is a round S2, by the way. And we expected it to emerge because you you expect to have the SU2 isometry that realizes R symmetry. Now, we are not done because I just told you what happens when the one form part, but there's also a three form part. And that just ends up determining H. So you might say there are many equations here, but well, one determines H and the others are redundant. And then you might, so if you were awake a couple of slides ago, perhaps, you might remember that there were a couple more equations. And one was this, and it just tells you basically that the dilaton is also a function of the parameter r, the coordinate r that I showed you in the previous slide. And the last one just determines F0 and F2 for you. And it turns out that the Bianchi identity for F2 more or less just automatically satisfied. This is something that sometimes happens. It's much more common that the equations, almost all the equations of motion are a consequence of supersymmetry in a supergravity theory. But sometimes even the Bianchi identities are a consequence. That depends a bit on the situation. This is, such an easy situation that it does happen automatically. And anyway, at the end of the day, you find that this case is still alive. We reduced everything to a certain system of three ODEs that I'm not showing you here, because it's a bit complicated. And one of the equations is the one that I was talking about, where that will determine how this x parameter that appears in the metric evolves. Now, the next question is, OK, so we have this system that tells you what the metric looks like, but we don't know yet whether the internal manifold can be made compact. And that will require somehow, well, there are two cases. Two possibilities that you can contemplate. The first is to that somehow you make the R coordinate periodic, and in this way, so that and S2 never shrinks. So perhaps this parameter x never goes to zero, but you make the R variable periodic, and so the topology will be S1 times S2. But we show that this is incompatible, actually, with the ODEs. This case is never realized. Now, almost looks like we're desperate, but there's one last possibility, which is that this guy goes to zero. Just like, well, remember, I told you that if this function is a cosine square, for example, or a sine square, then this would be the metric for round S3, What's particular about the cosine is that it goes to zero at 2 points. And what happens then is that the S2 shrinks, just like the just like a meridian on planet Earth shrinks at the North Pole or the South Pole, only for an S3. And so that's the other possibility for making, for having a compact space. And so in that case, you should have that this function shrinks for two values of R. And this works. If one includes brain sources, and I'll show you exactly how, so let's see. So we'll now see some explicit examples. Basically, those are the ones that I anticipated in the introduction. Well, let's first have a warm-up, something that I'm sure has been done a thousand times. So we didn't see it done, so we had to work it out, but it's not difficult. You can start with this, and I mentioned in the introduction, why don't you reduce it to A? And actually, your first reaction might be, oh, wait, so perhaps if you reduce it to 2A, it won't be an example of your system, because who tells you that it's going to remain supersymmetric? Something that happens all the time when you reduce is that your spinors, your fermionic parameters, your supersymmetry parameters, the epsilons, transform under the U1 that you want to reduce along. And so they are not included in the lower dimension action, because they transform, they have a momentum. So typically when you reduce, you only keep the zero momentum, zero Kaluza-Klein sector. And so that's, for example, what happens when you reduce from ADS4 tensor 7 to ADS4 tensor CP3, you lose at least two of the superchargers. And if you don't do it carefully, you can lose them even all. And so you might think, perhaps you will lose supersymmetry. But actually, if you think about it, there is a vector field that preserves supersymmetry. Basically works this way. So you have, if you take the cone that I mentioned already, the cone over this S4, so that you have an R5, then the vector that you want to consider is just a simultaneous rotation in the plane 1, 2, and 3, 4. If the angles are, if you do it at the same time with the same speed, so to speak, then you can work out pretty easily that that this preserves supersymmetry. It's just actually computation about spinors in flat space at that point. So, and this was implicitly, I implicitly already mentioned it when I said that there's a possibility of having S4 mod ZK, but we'll see it again. So then what happens? Think about S4 as an S3 vibration. So this is, I mentioned already something like this for the S3, now with a bit of mental gymnastics. So what is this picture? I hope that the color would show, this was supposed to be a little grayish. So what are these ellipses here? They were meant to be disks that represent the S3. So you have an S3 that shrinks, you have you can slice the S4 into copies of S3. So it's a S3 vibration of an interval. And at the extrema of the interval, you get a point. So this is S4. Now, I want to reduce along this vector. And this vector field happens to be vertical in the sense that it acts on each and every one of these S3s without spilling to the next one. And so now you have an S3, and basically it's a Hopf reduction. We remember that S3 can be written as a S1 vibration over S2. And well, what happens? Now you have an S2 vibration over an interval. Each of these S3s has become an S2, and they shrink at the interval. So what is it now? It should be an S3. Except if you do the computation, you find that, yes, it's topologically an S3, but there are two cusps. There are two singularities at the two extrema. But that's actually not surprising at all. Those two singularities are due to the fact that you have D6s. So we are used to the idea that when you reduce from 11 dimensions supergravity to 2a, the fixed locus of your U1 vector field along which you're reducing represents in 2a a singularity. And so you have this solution where in 2a you have ADS7 times M3, S3, with two singularities due to a bunch of D6, actually in this case, one D6, the North Pole, say, let's call this the North Pole, and one anti-D6 at the South Pole. This might look a little unsettling if you're used to flat space where D6s, brains and anti-brains would tend to annihilate each other, they would attract each other and then annihilate. But in this case, you have, basically you also have the curvature, so the metric. So there's indeed attraction. You would think, oh my God, this solution is unstable, but no, it isn't. This is indeed, would indeed be attracted to the other guy if you just moved it a tiny bit from here, but there's also a gravitational potential that keeps the whole thing in place.
I mean, you could, but there is probably a branch in which they are connected in here in the, at some distance in parallel.
There is a branch, but the wooden saying, I guess, is that we do expect that.
Because you pin them at the infinity.
You pin them here, but so you're saying, oh, I can, you are thinking about the brain configuration. But what I'm saying is, this guy is stable, as you would imagine for a supersymmetric solution. You might think naively that it might, this solution might be unstable. Well, here there's only 1d6, but if you think about the case, actually, so you can just as easily think about the case where you reduce, you have a zk here, and that generates k, d6s and anti-d6s, and the thought, all I'm saying is that the thought experiment you might want to do is to take one of those d6s and move it just a tiny bit away, and you might think that now it wants to immediately go to find the anti-6 brains and annihilate. So perhaps there is that possibility, but you have to overcome a potential barrier, and which is as it should be, because the supersymmetry solution is always stable. If this weren't the case, then this solution would be unstable. I mean, it would be a solution, but it would be unstable. So, yeah, so you can just as well have a situation with KD6s and K anti-D6s. And in a sense, this is, I've already anticipated this in the introduction a bit. In the sense, this is an analog of ABJM. What do I mean by that? So in ABJM, so this is the n equals 6 theory in three dimensions that gives us an alternative understanding of about the theory on the M2s. So the original problem of the of all these theories in, of M theory basically is that you don't have any parameter that you can tune to zero to make the theory weakly coupled. So you have no hope of ever finding a Lagrangian, except in the case of ABJM, people realize that you do have a parameter if you put M2s at the tip of a cone, which is a R4 mod ZK. So if you make that K large, basically you shrink the cone, and you do gain a parameter that, in a sense, can make your theory weakly coupled at the expense of some supersymmetry. In that case, you go from n equals 8 for the M2 theories to n equals 6 for this ABJM theory. Now, in this case, you lose some supersymmetry in this way. It's also you also have a quotient somewhere. Unfortunately, well, there's a bit some analogy to that situation in that you can also find the brain configuration that that you might think might help you finding a theory along the lines of EBGM. So you, this solution that I started with is actually the new horizon of the solution for N5 brains at the tip of the singularity. And we saw that it can be reduced to 2A with this result. So how do you go back? Well, you can actually, so this is not unexpected. You can even find a metric for this configuration. And this is the configuration here. Unfortunately, unlike for a BGM, now the field theory problem has not become easier. So I don't know whether this will ever teach us anything about the dynamics of the 2-0 theories. But it's an alternative 1,0 theory, and it has the property that when k equals 1, it goes back to the 2-0 theory, a bit like a BGM. So now the warm up is over. So let me introduce finally this Raman mass. This is nothing but one of the Raman fluxes of the theory, the one with no indices at all. So previously we had F2, which was sourced by the D6s, and now I'm also going to introduce F0. And let me try to, as much as possible, to avoid singularities. I mean, okay, so those that we saw in earlier were singularities which had an explanation, namely they were D6s. But, well, let me, I'll comment later about what would happen for D6s now, but let me first try to, as much as possible, not to have any singularity, to have a regular solution. So instead of having this cusp, I would want to have it smoothed out. So now, basically, you are imposing something on that. So remember, there was that function x of r that tells you how DS2 behaves as a function of r. And basically, you, if you want to impose that the point that the pole, this guy here, this point here, should be regular, as in this picture, then it, you are imposing some boundary condition on the system of these that I was mentioning. Some intuition can be gained by this. I mean, I showed you a system of three ODEs, but actually, by working a bit, you can eliminate one of them, and you end up with a flow that you, unfortunately, you cannot see very well, but a flow in a two-dimensional system. So the system is now autonomous, meaning so the time variable does not appear in the system. So it's just like following a vector field. And now it's in a two-dimensional space of parameters. What are the parameters? One is the x that appears in the metric. And the other happens to be the sum of dilaton and warping. I told you earlier that they are functionally related. So this is the flow that we the vector field, unfortunately, you cannot see very well, but basically the arrows are pointing this way, it's a stream. Now you have something like this, and there's some discontinuity here. Anyway, so what is the green dot here? The green dot is the boundary condition that I mentioned in the previous slide. So if you want a regular point, you have to start from that green dot. Well, you see already that you have to start from x equals 1 because the pole is supposed to be where the function in front of that. So this is the radius squared of the S2. So you would like it, you would like the S2 to shrink at the pole. And so you want x to be equal to 1. And you probably cannot see it either, but this is x equal to 1 here. But imposing that the point is also, should be also regular fixes even the value of the other parameter, so you end up with this green dot here. And if now if you follow, well, backwards actually, the vector field, you end up with this behavior.
Sorry?
F0 different from 0. From now on, I'm talking about F0 different from 0. Yes, thanks for that question. And, well, here you end up with a runaway. That looks terrible. But actually, if you go back to the original R variable, R does not go to infinity, but it converges to a certain finite value. However, you do end up with something not regular, but then you look at it, you go back to original coordinates, you look at it, and you go, oh, wait, I've seen this before. It's actually just the same as the behavior near an ordinary D6. Almost the same. Let's say the behavior of the metric, the asymptotic behavior of the metric is exactly the same as the one for the 6. And so basically you can picture, so this point, the regular point is here, this pole. Now, these are the S2s that enlarge, and then they shrink again, but they shrink not in a regular way, they shrink, well, in a way that you can interpret anyhow, is with k anti-D6s. This is the, so perhaps this I should have stressed before. So the, remember when in the massless solution we had two bunches of D6s and anti-D6s, right? What is that singularity like? Well, you might think, I know the D6 solution, I can I can look it up in many references. There is, however, a little difference due to the fact that you're working in ADS, already in a massless case. Namely, H there is exploding, which does, surely doesn't happen for the ordinary D6. The reason for that is, in that case, it comes about because you are reducing from ADS4 times ADS7 times S4, and in S4 you had a four-form flux. Now, if you write the form, when you reduce the four-form flux to 2A, well, you write it as E11, I don't know, wedge H plus potentially F3, which here we don't have. And so this goes to zero, basically, so H has to explode. So there's nothing strange in that happening. Now, in that case, in this case, we have exactly the same behavior. However, in that case, that singularity you don't really worry about it because you know that you can go to M theory, and there you have a perfectly smooth solution. Now, however, we are in 2A with massive, with the Romance mass switched on. So it is singular. We don't have M theory available to reduce this singularity. So I would say the status of this particular solution here is debatable. I don't know whether, since we don't have M theory to resolve it.
Is k the same as the number of F0?
The same as the number of?
Is k the same as F0?
No. No. In the previous case, for example, it was F0 was 0.
No, but here in this particular example.
I found this as a supergravity solution, and as far as supergravity goes, as usual, quantization rules, they're not enforced. You have to enforce them by hand, and so this is a free parameter, let's say. So you can have as many as you want, but there is this, But if you look at the Bianchi identity, you have this result here. So there is a relation between H, F0. Okay. Well, H is, I can only really answer this question because much of this is numerics, but that, it can be many things. I don't know if it can be anything you want.
The flow is fixed, right? So your starting point.
The flow is fixed. Well, there is one free parameter, which is the value of A here. That is free. What is A from the point of view of, so A is this, the warping function, so you have the square 10 equals e to the 2A. Yeah, so this, indeed, so, but you're thinking already about deriving this from some kind of brain configuration, which I don't know how to do.
No, okay, no, so not this is that one.
This is the massive.
No, I was asking if the same romance mass, I meant. Exactly.
The same with the without romance mass.
I'm saying k is the product of zero and the number of NS fibers.
Yeah, again, if in this, but I don't know. Oh, you're thinking about our what we discussed.
Yeah, so. I was thinking the
so David is jumping a bit ahead.
No, no,
when we met on Monday, we came up with a possible field theory dual to this story. But I feel I cannot comment about what we found on Monday. So yes. In terms of what we were discussing Monday, on Monday, yes, absolutely. In the case without the mass, then no, the solution, this formula, then k is free, but you don't have f zero.
But do we not quantization also in mass
effect, right? F zero is quantized.
But what about the integral of h?
It's also quantized, but they, things work out so that k is quantized as it should.
So integral of h is the number of
next five
steps. Oh no.
I would say that h is quantized even if you don't have any source. So for me, flux quantization works even if you don't have any.
Yes, so
it's a flux, indeed it's called flux quantization.
It's, an
it's up to pi that I'm showing here, it's an integer, yes.
Okay.
Integer equals integer.
Okay. So.
Then you can modify this situation a little bit. So it actually, so suppose you start from here and you almost get to the, so what I did here was I started with a previous solution, but I perturbed it a bit and you can go backwards. And this is actually a repulsive point. So if you miss it just by a little bit, you get something entirely different. And you can look up what happens whether you lift it, miss it from the left or from the right. And basically, you get that the other pole, which one, the one which was regular, now also develops a singularity. Only in this case, you have the sixes, and in this case, you have an O6. You can have an O6 at the other end.
So O6 is the part form of the dihedral?
Sorry?
O6 means part form of the dihedral
group. So the
it
mod.
This wasn't here, and it is.
The O6 is just this antipodal action on the S2, basically. And so the O6 plane happens.
So if there was no F0, this would be. I guess it must be an O6.
Without F0, this would not be possible because now instead of having K. So basically, you have K equals F0 times H, and now you have. So number of the sixes at one pole, north pole, minus number of the sixes at south pole. And what I'm saying is that this guy can also become the charge of an O6. But the difference of the two charges is what now ends up being related.
So you could have O6, O6.
O6 at both
yes,
sides.
That is a non-solution, right? Because that's a form of diagonal.
Yeah, but no, in the mass. Okay, good. I hadn't thought of that. But okay, good. Sorry. Now I understand. Only now I understand. I hadn't thought of that possibility in the mass situation.
But now this indeed. Is really weird with the diagonal on one side. And
but yeah, in this case, in this case, I don't think you can do that without something because
no,
you see.
There's F0, so.
Now there's F0.
In another dimensions, you could have taken it as 7RP4. That is still symmetric, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so perhaps I. So
the
I thought. I, no, good, good.
Kind of oriented holes in theory, so yeah.
I guess you found a weak spot in my. So, see, my classification was I focused on the new part, which is the masses part, the massive part. I guess, yes, in the there is one more possibility in the. So, when I say I said it says 4 mod ZK, I guess, yeah, you also have that other case.
So the mass effect in a six plane can end on an S5.
Massive.
Yes, essentially telling us that it's in the middle of the horizon. In massive pathway, in a six plane can end on an S5 plane.
Looks. You have a map. Yeah, but you have some D6s going out the other way. Well, the other, so this one is more conventional, right? Because you can have, it's what we discussed the other day with the D6s that end on NS5, and then you have a different number emerging from the other side. So anyway, this is just a comment I made earlier that in this case, anyway, we don't have any theory to justify this singularity, so perhaps we should wait and, before we discuss, we attach too much meaning to these solutions. But one notable thing is that the behavior of these singularities for the D6s and O6s is just a, more or less the same, other than for Sandite, as the one without F0. Whereas there is at least another situation related to the solutions, ADS4 solutions by De Wolf, Kachru, Giriavets, and Taylor, where you can show that introducing F0 and modifying the ansatz for the metric in a certain way actually desingularizes the O6. So this, apparently this doesn't appear here. Let me end with a way to now make both poles regular. And you might have disappointed that I told you, I don't know what the status of these solutions is. So what, are you sure that you really have found new solutions that are physical? Because I told you the previous ones are, perhaps they're unphysical. Well, let me introduce an extra ingredient. So D8s. That's the most natural thing to introduce in a massive type 2A theory. So what happens then? if you change, so a D8 will change the value of F0 along the way. So that picture that I was showing you before of the flow gave you a feeling of inelutability that you had to follow that and go to the singularity. But if you now have you change F0 along the way, perhaps the behavior can change. And so let's see. First of all, so let me tell you that I'll also allow the D8s to be magnetized, so they also have induced the 6 charge. And now the Bianchi for F2 is no longer automatic. Earlier I told you it would be automatic, but I really meant away from the 8s. Now if you have the 8s, you have to work a little harder to impose the correct equation with the correct expression for what's in front of the delta function. And if you work a bit, you find that this fixes the position of the D8, which makes a lot of physical sense. And you can also check that it's it coincides with what you will get by calibration computation. Now, formally, calibration usually is appropriate. Usually, a calibration computation is appropriate when a brain is up. You have only one brain, which is lighter than the rest. For D8s are never really that light, so perhaps that's why you get the same condition. Now, the flow changes, and you cannot see the. So you flow for a while exactly in the same way as before, but then you encounter the D8, and the flow changes. And so you don't go all the way here, but you do something else. And now here, I'm putting another D8, and I end up on a similar green dot, which is now appropriate for the other pole, and that I couldn't reach before. And so this is now a plot of the solution. What is this plot here? You have the warping function. Before, for example, for the masses, so this region in between here is actually for f with F0 equal 0. And if F0 were equal to 0 all the way, you would find that the warping function would go to 0 at the two poles, which is one of the features of this of the presence of the D6s. This is the dilaton. Actually, I have risked the dilaton is much smaller than this, so the solution is completely under control. I've rescaled it to make it visible. And this is the radius of the transverse S2. You can see here there's a little bump. And the solution is completely regular. Here's a cartoon what happens. This is the one that we saw in the introduction. So these are the D8s. These are the regular points. And so at this point, I would argue that this is completely physical because, okay, so perhaps you can say, oh, the six singularity, I don't know whether I can justify it in the massive theory because I don't have non-perturbability completion about the theory. And of course, that so I don't actually believe in that kind of line of argument, but I can understand that it has some merit. But at least at the D8, you should allow me to have at least a D8 in the massive theory. So, from the point of view, I mean, this is a very benign singularity, barely deserves to be called a singularity. It's just a discontinuity in the field. That's all that a D8 introduces, unlike other brains. So, this, in my opinion, is a perfectly physical solution. And there should be similar solutions with many, like more sausage-like solutions with many more bunches of D8s. I told you that there are a few questions that we were not really able to. This is numeric, so I don't know. The examples we found F naught is always equal to zero in the middle region. So we found also solutions with more D8s, but this was always the case. So open question that says if it's always so. And one can also, there is a more general solution where you have both D8s and D6s. So you can add D6s at the poles. But it's likely that actually this is the correct solution in the sense that the D6s will want to expand into this type of D8 by Myers effect. Someone asked why. It looks looks natural.
If you put them there, you boundary conditions to infinity, and they are supersymmetric.
So
how would it be different from when there were no D8s?
So you're asking whether the solution with D6s would be any different from this? I would have basically this discontinuity here, but also a cusp here. It would be different from this one.
If you didn't complain about this instability for a score mod ZK, what would you complain about here?
It would be a non-perturbative instability. That's what I'm conjecturing, but perhaps.
I'm saying, does F0 somehow make this unstable?
Well, F0 would be just, if you think about it as F10, would be just the right one to create a Myers effect. That's the reason I'm. So supergravity doesn't tell you this. Supergravity tells you that's a fine solution. But the Myers effect you wouldn't really see with those instruments. So I'm conjecturing that somehow. That's just a off the cuff remark. Oh yeah, so all these brains are all extended along the whole of ADS7 because otherwise I would have broken the symmetry group of ADS7. Perhaps I should have been more clear about this. So when I pictured the D6 as a point, it was because it was extended along the whole of ADS7. And these D8s here, for example, are extended along the whole of ADS7 plus these two directions, which makes a total of 9, which is appropriate for D8. Right, conclusions. So using this pure spinor methods, we classified all of the ADS7 solutions in type 2 without any ansatz whatsoever. Without any ansatz, we reduced it to a certain system of ODEs that then can be pictured as a flow and can be studied. The flow can be studied numerically. Perhaps some of you can even find the analytic solution, I don't know. Now, what we found is that there are no solutions in type 2b, but many new ones in type 2a, which have this feature that the internal manifold is topologically S3, and it can have different shapes depending on whether you allow the D6s or you have just the D8s. Thank you.
functions without solving anything?
Without solving anything?
Like, no, it is 700 at the end now.
Oh, well, you are saying by putting, I mean, the brain picture is not suggestive of ADS7 solution. That is correct, but sometimes this intuition fails. You have ADS4 solutions in 2B.
Oh, yeah? Yep.
Yes. So how the heck are you going to explain that?
Because weird things can do weird stuff. Also programmers.
Or even the fact, so, and you might say, oh my god, how does this come about? So first of all, I know plenty of solutions that are not, for which the brain configuration is not known. Mm-hmm. So that they are not a new horizon or anything, or I should say, are not known to be new horizon or anything. And that actually, it's me from inside, and I'm really unhappy, but that's just how it is. And we should live with the fact that holography is more general, right? I mean, it originated in the study of brains, but find another solution, even in another theory, which is not spin theory, the same rules apply. High spin theory, I don't know. Now, in those many cases, I think you can explain the ADS, the strange ADS that you're finding by focusing on brain intersections. So for example, this ADS7 times M3 in the Masse solution, if you look at it, that you've found by reduction, if you look at it, of course you should find it because you've found it by reduction from the M5 theory, but if you didn't know about M theory and you said, oh my god, where does this ADS7 come from? It's from the intersection, you realize it at the intersection of this D6 and NS5s. It's a bit different than how it works in general. The D6s and the NS5s by themselves wouldn't give rise to an ADS, but their intersection somehow is a little bit different. In that case, I actually happen to know the exact solution, and I can check it by hand, that if you have brain intersections, you have different phenomena than the ones, than the exact. Yeah, they are rare, or yeah, they are. Aren't you working on those? you told me so.
It's nicer if you can prove, I would say.
But is it like non-superlative?
Look, I think. So these are basically, this basically have to do with the brain configurations a la Hanani Witt and stuff like this, where you, in my opinion, what you're doing all the time is you're focusing on the brains that go like this, sorry, I mean, now I'm. So you have in a Hanani-Witten-like configuration, so you have NS5s, and you have some brains, depending on the dimension, that go like this. And I think what you're doing is you're focusing on an intersection between an NS5 and a D-brain that goes like this. And perhaps at the same time, you're also doing something else. I mean, this, but these are conjectures. So.
Central charges of the dual qubits. I mean, I can imagine in this case of calculating whatever the volume of this internal manifold.
Yeah, I guess you could. I haven't done this computation.
I was wondering if it scales as
recently some.
Does it scale?
Yeah, that's a. No, that's really a good computation that I should have done. I apologize. it's a very interesting question.
Great, let's